From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the case of the frozen addicts. In 1982, several heroin users injected a bad batch of a designer drug. It left them paralyzed, as if they'd turned to stone. We'll talk with neurologist William Langston, who investigated this medical mystery. The solution he found offers clues to reversing the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Also today, childless in America, we talk with historian Elaine Tyler May about what it means to not have children, either by choice or circumstance. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new CDs featuring the work of the late composer and pianist Herbie Nichols. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A Massachusetts judge says alleged murderer John Salvi is competent to stand trial. Salvi is charged with killing two people and wounding five more in two Boston area's women's clinics that perform abortions. A defense psychiatrist had testified Salvi shouldn't stand trial because he suffers from schizophrenia. But prosecutors argued that Salvi should, since they say he methodically planned last December's attack for months and thus say he is fit to be tried. President Clinton attended the memorial service today of three U.S. diplomats who died in a road accident in Bosnia last weekend. The president eulogized Robert Fraser, Joseph Cruzel, and Samuel Nelson Drew as men who gave their lives for peace.
Bob, Joe, and Nelson each represented the finest qualities of American citizenship. For their service and their sacrifice in the cause of peace and freedom, it is my honor on this day to award them each the President's Citizen Medal.
Mr. Clinton has appointed new diplomats to take up the work of the men who died. The new U.S. mediators will go to Europe with a Clinton administration proposal to end the Bosnian War. This plan divides the country into ethnic zones. The mediators meet in Paris next week with Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic. Barry Schwein has more.
When the American mediators go back to Europe, their objectives will be the same ones they have pursued for weeks, selling the warring factions on a proposal that would give Bosnian Serbs control over about half the country. Getting them to accept that idea is the first priority, and that means getting the president of Serbia, Slobodan Milosevic, to lean on the Bosnian Serbs. To accomplish all this, the U.S. is offering concessions, a suspension of the trade embargo imposed against Milosevic's Serbia by the UN, and a division of Bosnia into ethnic parts. Also inevitably, the U.S. would help rebuild the country after 4 years of war. The Bosnian government is willing to go along in order to halt the bloodshed, denying all the way that the country is being carved up. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwein at the State Department.
Israel says it's arrested the suspected mastermind behind two most recent suicide bombings and 29 accomplices. The head of the Israeli Secret Service has identified the mastermind as 27-year-old Abdel Nasser Issa. He's accused in the bus bombing in Jerusalem last Monday that killed five people, including an American. He's also wanted for a bombing last month in Tel Aviv that killed another seven people. The arrests are seen as a breakthrough for Israeli security forces. Previous efforts have never yielded those so close to the bombings. On Wall Street, the Dow is down nearly 18 points at 4,602. This is NPR. Eastman Kodak Company has reached a deal with a Japanese distributor to get its film products on more store shelves in Japan. Walter Gabalski of member station WXXI in Rochester, New York, reports.
Several kinds of Kodak film will be sold through a Japanese wholesale chain at some 800 sales outlets throughout Japan. One of the products will carry both companies' names and will be sold by the stores at about half the current Kodak film price in Japan. Kodak's Paul Allen says it's the third such deal the photo giant has announced this year in an effort to grab a larger share of the Japanese market.
The thing you have to bear in mind is our case describes, the case that we filed with the U.S. Trade Representative, 70% of the market is still locked up for Fuji.
Kodak has accused the Japanese government and Fuji Photo Film of unfair trade practices, alleging Kodak has been shut out of Japan. Company officials hope this week's deal and a case being investigated by the U.S. Trade Representative will make inroads for Kodak Film in Japan. For National Public Radio, I'm Walter Gabalski in Rochester, New York.
China says its relations with the United States have fallen to their lowest point since 1979. That's when the two countries established diplomatic ties. The Chinese state news agency has printed a long commentary about the ties and concludes that Americans are guilty of Cold War thinking. A senior U.S. diplomat is due to arrive in China tomorrow. Undersecretary of State Peter Tarnoff will talk about several tough issues, including the Chinese detention of American citizen Harry Wu. Iraq says it never had plans to invade Saudi Arabia and Kuwait this month. The Iraqi information minister denies claims by a prominent Iraqi defector that President Hussein was planning an invasion. He says the claim is a distortion campaign. But defector Hussein Kamal al-Majid says his departure earlier this month prevented the invasion plan. A spokesman for the Iraqi opposition based in London agrees. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. William Langston's new book, The Case of the Frozen Addicts, is a medical mystery. It includes an unlikely meeting of dissimilar characters and some highly implausible coincidences, but I can't criticize the story since it's all true. Dr. Langston is a neurologist in Northern California. In 1982, he was called in to help diagnose a mysterious disorder. Several young people had turned up in the emergency rooms of area hospitals. They were alive and conscious, but their bodies were frozen like statues. In his book, Dr. Langston tells of how he figured out what was wrong with the patients, the treatments he used, and how these events led to a breakthrough in the treatment of Parkinson's disease, a neurological disorder which interferes with voluntary movement, causes twitches and spasms, and can eventually leave a person prisoner in their own body. As Dr. Langston worked to solve the mystery, he discovered one common thread. All of the patients had recently used heroin.
Well, it turned out that back in 1982, a clandestine chemist here in the San Francisco Bay Area was trying to make what was being called synthetic heroin, which was part of what we called the designer drug phenomenon here in California. These young, bright chemists were able to make their own drugs, tailoring them to individual needs, literally. Unfortunately, however, this one chemist made a bad batch, and instead of making what was called China White, it was a synthetic heroin, made probably the most selective brain toxin that's ever been discovered to date. And when that happened and this stuff hit the streets, we started seeing young drug addicts literally freezing up overnight, like walking zombies. In fact, the addicts themselves have a name for it. They call it the walking death. But these young people couldn't move, couldn't talk. Many of them could still walk, oddly, but were frozen, literally prisoners in their own bodies. And these patients started showing up in emergency rooms here in the Bay Area.
How did you enter the picture?
Well, I was called out of a busy clinic one morning by my fellow, someone who was training under me, literally desperate for me to see this case, the likes of which he'd never seen before. And I must say I was a little annoyed at first, but finally went over to see this patient. And when I walked into the examining room, it stopped me in my tracks. Here was an individual sitting literally motionless like a statue. You could pick up his arm, put it in a position, and it would just stay there for up to 15 to 20 minutes at a time. Looked for all the world like what we call catatonic schizophrenia. But it turned out there were some telltale signs to me as a neurologist clearly pointed out to some type of brain damage. So we knew we had a first-class medical mystery on our hands, but what it was, of course, we didn't know. And this patient, since he couldn't talk, most people thought he was mentally out of it. But one of the real stunners came when a medical student on the third day was in the hospital, held up a piece of paper against his hand. And to everybody's amazement, this man wrote, "I don't know why or what is happening to me. I only know I can't move normally. I know what I want to do, but I just can't do it." He was totally normal inside this frozen body. And it took us about a half day to take a history from him, answering questions, and he would write mostly yes or no. But it turned out the key word in this lengthy, multi-paged history was the word heroin. And with time, we discovered other young people who had had a similar fate. And the only common link between these patients in different hospitals in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, was the use of heroin. And that's what really led us to the cause.
It's amazing that this man who you're mentioning could write, although he couldn't move or speak.
Yeah, we were literally stunned. There's an old adage. It's one of the first things you're taught in medical school, and that is to never talk at the bedside. You never know. Even if a patient looks comatose, you never know what they can hear. And in fact, this man inside was completely normal, had heard everything that happened to him. One of the most amazing stories, really, is he was in the emergency room, and often when doctors can't figure out what's going on, and sometimes it's assumed the patient might be faking it, they will administer painful stimuli to try to snap them out of it. And they had done that with this patient, and he, of course, was livid inside and when in pain, actually tried to hit one of the doctors, but he moved so slowly nobody in the emergency room even noticed he was taking a swing.
This is like if Edgar Allan Poe was writing about neurological disorders.
Yeah, it sure is.
So what were the telltale signs to you as a neurologist that this was a neurological disorder?
Well, it's an obscure sign, but I had seen catatonic schizophrenics before, which is it's a typical thing when you don't know what a patient has. So often people get labeled as psychiatric, and that's what had happened with a number of these addicts. But with Parkinson's disease, when you move a joint back and forth, say the wrist or the elbow, you not only encounter resistance, which you see in catatonic schizophrenia, but you get a little ratchety feel. The joint lets loose in little jumps, like just like the ratchet on a wrench. And that's a classic finding in Parkinson's disease, and that told me that this was not catatonic schizophrenia. You don't see that in catatonics, so that's what really turned my opinion around on the case.
So you saw some connections between the condition of the addicts and Parkinson's disease.
Yes, although it was discombobulating. These young people looked for all the world as if they had advanced severe Parkinson's disease. But that just didn't fit. Parkinson's disease takes years to evolve. This had come on literally overnight. And these people were young, whereas Parkinson's typically hits the elderly. So we were greatly puzzled, but in really desperation, began to administer a drug called L-DOPA to these young people, not so much because we thought they had Parkinson's, but because they were dying, and this was a life-saving measure. And the results were stunning. Several of these people who had been totally frozen literally overnight recovered almost completely. One patient I remember within 3 days was normal again as this Parkinson's melted away to the point that I thought his whatever had caused his problem had disappeared, and we stopped the drug only to see him freeze up again. For anyone who saw the movie The Awakenings, which is another form of Parkinsonism, that exact experience was recounted in that movie.
But while those patients unfroze, it must have been remarkable to get the story of what it felt like when they were frozen.
It was remarkable and chilling, really, to hear what it's like to be locked inside your body, watching life go by, and not being able to tell anybody what was happening. Our first patient's girlfriend, we kept hearing, was frozen, and it took us 2 weeks to cajole the family to bring her in. It turned out they were afraid because of her heroin use. They were afraid of the law. But when she arrived, she looked like a mannequin in a department store. No blinking, no facial expression, no spontaneous movements. And it turned out the family had actually would get her up in the morning, bathe her, feed her, dress her, put her in a chair, and in the evening they would reverse that process and put her back to bed. I don't know how long that would have gone on if we hadn't been able to get them to bring her in.
So you administered the drug L-DOPA, which is used for people with Parkinson's disease?
Yes, that's right.
And that got them out of that frozen state. But then there were side effects that set in, serious side effects.
Yes, in fact, in some cases, terrifying side effects. Again, for anyone who saw Awakenings, this was very well portrayed by Robert De Niro in that movie. With time, in regular Parkinson's disease, one starts seeing these side effects. The most problematic ones include excessive movement, too much movement, jumpy, twisty, turny movements, hallucinations, confusion. That's one of the most difficult. These things all slow down one's ability to treat the disease, and in fact, sometimes eventually you have to stop these drugs at a time when they're most needed. So that's what we saw in these patients. Only instead of taking years to evolve, we began seeing these side effects within days to weeks in several of the patients. So I remember one young woman, in fact, this was her first experience with drugs, Connie. She began getting terrifying hallucinations of doctors chasing her and trying to stab her and kill her and kill her son, to the point that we finally had to stop the drug altogether.
And did she return to the frozen state?
Completely.
What a terrible choice to... I mean, there's no good choice in a situation like that.
It's lose-lose. Lose-lose. But we just had nowhere to go. I think these hallucinations must have been something like Dante's Hell. But again, what's worse? I mean, to be sitting there locked inside. She watched her young 4-year-old son grow up during those years, unable to even hug him or put him on her lap or anything. Very sad.
Eventually, you hooked up with a team of Swedish doctors who were doing research on fetal tissue transplants. What made you think that that might be helpful for your patients who are frozen?
Well, they had developed all of these terrible and disabling side effects of L-DOPA therapy, and were really no longer having any type of meaningful life. Connie, this young woman who was the most severely affected, I was quite concerned was going to die. Because they were having all these side effects, there was really no future with drug therapy. And I had been hearing about some very cutting-edge research that was being done in Sweden, transplanting fetal tissue into the adult human brain to try to treat neurodegenerative disease, particularly Parkinson's. One of the many ironies of this story was that what really sprung that research was I was on a speaking engagement in Brussels when we're going out to a summer palace to meet with the hostess of this symposium. The bus we were on got lost and eventually stuck in a cow pasture, and we were sitting there in the pounding rain for 2 hours with nothing to do while we were rescued, and I happened to be sitting next to, in the dark, the head of the Swedish transplant team, a Dr. Anders Borkland. And the more we talked, the more it became obvious that these patients, these young people, were perfect candidates for this procedure. They did not have a progressive disease. They were otherwise young and healthy. They had their whole lives ahead of them, and if there was anything left that could offer them hope, it seemed to be this fetal transplant procedure. And out of that was born a scientific collaboration.
Would you explain for us why fetal tissue transplants of brain fetal tissue, can be effective for people with Parkinson's?
Well, let me start at the beginning. When we're born, we are born with all of our brain cells, our full component. We never make another brain cell, so you're stuck with what you've got when you're born. So if you lose brain cells when you get older for any reason, you can never make another one. This puts some real severe limitations on our brains and, of course, probably accounts for these diseases that they tend to get. So the only theoretical hope for a cure would be to replace those cells. And the first attempt to do that was the use of taking fetal tissue that started in rats, really, taking that tissue out and transplanting it into rats that had lesions in their brain to see if they could return memory or movement to the animals. And, in fact, it worked. These cells grow in the adult brain. They thrive. They make the chemicals that are necessary for the brain to function normally. And even more extraordinarily, these cells, these strangers, hook up and synapse and begin to talk to communicate with the surrounding normal brain. And that was the beginning of this whole approach to trying to treat diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's with fetal tissue.
My guest is neurologist Dr. William Langston. His new book is called The Case of the Frozen Addicts. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Neurologist Dr. William Langston is my guest. So you wanted to try fetal tissue transplants and see if that would work on the addicts that you were dealing with who were frozen as a result of that designer drug that they'd used. What were the results?
Well, the results have been, and I want to temper my enthusiasm here because medicine's so full of false hopes, pretty remarkable. One of the patients turned out she was a 95% Cree Chippewa Indian, which we didn't know, and was so disabled she'd returned to the reservation in Montana where her family lived for total care. She has gotten to the point now, she's now about 4 years out from transplantation, that she is living independently. The chiefs of the village recently gave her her own home. She actually returned to school, to a junior college, to try to get her high school equivalency and actually wants to do drug abuse counseling. I would say a very fitting thing for her to do. So it's given her her life back. It's pretty dramatic. Connie, the young woman that was most severely affected, who hadn't had any movement at all for probably 5 years, is now riding an exercise bicycle, can get from room to room, is talking. It's been pretty miraculous. She's still very disabled. I wouldn't say we've got a cure, but if you look where she started, it's very impressive. And I have to say that once she got to where she could talk, I did ask her what was it like being trapped in there all those years and watching everything go by. And her comments, really just two words, lonely and depressed, which personally I don't know how she kept her sanity. But she is coming back, and it's really been something to see.
So you had to take these addicts who were frozen to Sweden because the fetal tissue transplants would have been illegal in the States.
Well, research was really on a hold in this country. That's not why I really started. It was because they were the leaders in the field and no one else was doing it when we first started. But in the middle of all this, President Reagan chose to impose a ban on the use of all fetal cells, human fetal cells, for any type of research. And that had an absolutely chilling effect on research in this country, stopped it cold, really. So there wasn't much going on. There really wasn't much opportunity to do anything in the United States. President Bush chose to continue that ban. I must say, though, that Bill Clinton, I think it was his second day in office, lifted that ban. And as a result of that, there's quite a bit of research being done again in this area. We now hear with the new Republican Congress that there are all types of rumblings of reimposing the ban again. And I have to say that would have far-reaching consequences. Many don't realize it, but this type of research is being used for a number of other diseases, Huntington's chorea, ALS, motor neuron disease, stroke, and even diseases such as childhood leukemia. So it's not just one disease we're talking about.
How did the Swedish deal with the ethical questions surrounding fetal tissue research?
Their approach is a wonderful study, I think, in thoughtfulness in how one should deal with something like this. They first went to the Swedish Medical Ethics Committee, and then they went to the Swedish Parliament, which has an ethics committee. And all of this was done before they ever did one experiment in humans. Their guidelines, I think, everybody has adopted since, and they are crucial. I think this type of research must have extremely tight guidelines, and the critical ones are, first, that there can be no money exchanged whatsoever. Obviously, that could have horrible implications, black markets and so forth and so on.
In other words, you can't sell the tissue of somebody's fetus.
Can't sell it. Should absolutely be illegal. Certainly, ethically, it's totally unacceptable. Secondly, and interestingly turning out to be almost as important, is that there has to be complete anonymity between donor and recipient. And I'm now aware personally of a case where a woman was seriously considering conceiving to get fetal tissue to treat her husband's Parkinson's, something we never would have done, of course, but that type of thing has to be absolutely avoided. And if you make it a very strict requirement that there has to be complete anonymity between donor and recipient, you get rid of that problem.
Now, in Sweden, does a woman who's having an abortion have to give permission
Yes,
for the
does.
Fetus to be used in medical research.
She does. She is not told whether that tissue will actually be used or not. But she is asked to give permission. You get into another very interesting ethical argument there, because I've heard some people argue that any woman who's chosen to have an abortion has given up all rights to that fetus, has abandoned her responsibility, if you will. But I think all medical groups I know of working in this area feel very strongly that a woman would have to give informed consent for that to be used.
So what is the status now of fetal tissue experiments in Sweden?
Well, the Swedes are very slow and very methodical. They continue to do this work. They now have one patient who is, I believe, approaching 3 years off of all medications and still quite functional. They've done about 15 to 20 patients. That's something that's approaching, I don't want to use the word cure, but something close to that. But they only have one. There are major technical problems with fetal cell tissue work. We don't get very high survival when this is done. Only about 10% of the cells survive, and that may be why most of the responses are partial. I think in the long run, it's not going to be the answer. I think in the long run, just because of supply issues, if this morning after pill ever comes out, that's going to be the end of it anyway. We're going to have to find alternates, and there are many new directions afoot, including the use of genetically engineered cells. There's a company here in California that has actually developed a technique to take skin cells, the patient's own skin cells, biopsy them, grow them up, teach them genetically to make dopamine. It's called genetic engineering, and then transplanting those very same born-again skin cells into the brain to replace the missing chemical, which is dopamine, in Parkinson's. This would solve all of the problems, the ethical issues, the supply issues, and the issue of rejection, rejecting tissue, because it's the patient's own skin. So we're looking at these things as we speak.
So the case of the frozen addicts, the addicts who unknowingly shot designer drugs that ruined their brains, the case of the frozen addicts enabled you to do research that's now paying off for Parkinson's disease.
Yes, it's... If there is such a thing as a hope from tragedy story, this is really it. The discovery of a chemical that reproduced all of the symptoms and signs of Parkinson's literally set off a research revolution. It led to the first good animal model for the disease. It's allowed for ways to test new drugs almost instantaneously. It's led to the hypothesis that a chemical like that may be in the environment and actually be the cause of the disease. It's given us a way to study why nerve cells die in the brain under certain types of insults. So it's a rather unbelievable story when you think about it, that bad dope, sloppy chemistry, some damaged, tragic addicts would lead to this incredible resurgence of research for a major human disease.
Dr. Langston, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, my pleasure.
Dr. William Langston's new book is called The Case of the Frozen Addicts. He's the president of the Parkinson's Institute in Sunnyvale, California. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the music of the late composer and pianist Herbie Nichols. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of the Herbie Nichols Trio, which we're listening to now, and a new interpretation of Nichols' work by the Buell Neidlinger Quintet. Also, historian Elaine Tyler May examines what it means to be childless in America. Her new book is Barren in the Promised Land. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Contraception has made it possible for couples to have an active sex life and remain childless. At the same time, science and technology offer new solutions for couples who want children but can't conceive. Elaine Tyler May studies the history of the family. She's the author of the new book, Barren in the Promised Land, A History of Childlessness and Attitudes Toward It. To find out how women today feel about being childless, she placed author queries in hundreds of newspapers and journals, asking childless people to relate their stories. She has a personal story that relates to the subject. Her father devoted his medical practice to the study and treatment of infertility. He was among the clinical researchers who developed the oral contraceptive.
It was kind of funny. I could remember times when friends from college would come home and visit, and I would very proudly say, you know, my dad was one of the developers of the birth control pill, and they would turn to my father with beaming smiles and say in raptured tones, "Oh, thank you, Dr. Tyler." And my father would just bristle at this because, that wasn't his idea, that he was working on a contraceptive technique for me and my other single friends, but rather this was something he thought of very strongly in terms of family planning and not in terms of enabling single women to engage in non-marital sexual activity. So there was some disjunction there between what he thought about his work and what purposes it was taken. And I think that was probably true for a lot of the people working in reproductive medicine at the time.
Did your father lecture you about the pill? Did he expect you to take it or not take it when you were single?
Oh, there was no question in my household that the pill was not to be taken when we were single. When I married, then we had some talks about birth control from, you know, the medical and health standpoint and what would be most appropriate and safest and that kind of thing. But, oh, no, it was never anything I would have raised with my father about sex outside of marriage.
So your father's work with the pill helped make voluntary childlessness a more plausible choice. And you give an interesting statistic in your new book. In 1990, 25% of all women aged 30 to 45 were childless, compared to only 16% who were childless in 1976. What are some of the things that you think account for that increase in childlessness?
Well, the first thing to remember is that that's a fairly recent increase, and that in fact, if you go back a little bit further, there were higher levels of childlessness prior to World War II. In fact, the highest levels were in the 1930s, just on the eve of World War II. So I think what's happening here is that the rate of childlessness actually dropped in half after World War II at the time of the baby boom, when everybody was either planning to have children or having them or trying to have them. So I think if we look at the baby boom era as a kind of oddity historically, because the pronatalist pressures and the reproductive behavior was so unusual, then we can understand that somehow the increase in childlessness since that time is more toward a normal, for the American population at any rate, more toward a normal level of childlessness within the population, although, of course, it is much easier now for people who are married or sexually active to control their fertility, so the chances of people remaining childless, if they actually want to remain childless, are much higher than they used to be.
You know, for those of us who are part of the baby boom, it's so hard to consider the baby boom period as a blip, an abnormality. It's what I grew up with thinking is, you know, what normal was.
Right. And I think that's one of the problems we actually have today in the current political climate, is that the rhetoric, the political rhetoric that is often tossed around, seems to point to the post-World War II years, particularly the 1950s, and a model of white middle-class nuclear family with X numbers of children as the norm, as the, quote, traditional family. And in fact, there was nothing at all traditional about the post-war family. It was really a bizarre formulation that existed really only once in American history and vanished rather quickly. After 20 years, it was gone.
What was unusual about the post-war nuclear family?
Well, if you want to look just at the demographics, first of all, the marriage age dropped precipitously. People were marrying at a very, very young age. And you often hear that during the 40s and the 50s, the rate of premarital, and that was always the way it was measured, the rate of premarital sexual activity did not increase. But since it was always measured against a marital standard, the question was never asked about teenage pregnancy. Well, teenage pregnancy and teenage sexual behavior went up dramatically during those years, but the fact is those teenagers were married. The marriage age was so low that lots and lots of people were marrying during the teen years and having children, and the birth rate was going up reflecting that. The marriage rate was going up. The divorce rate actually went down because there was a very, very, very strong pressure to remain married once you got married. So you have a huge rush into married life and childbearing that was really very unusual and lasted, as I said, about 20 years and then it vanished just as quickly as it emerged. And now we're really at more typical levels of marriage age, marriage rate, and childlessness.
My guest is Elaine Tyler May, author of the new book, Barren in the Promised Land. It's about being childless. We're after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Elaine Tyler May. Her new book is A History of Childlessness. I'm interested in the range of reasons you found why many people are remaining childless by choice. You say that it's really more than just access to good contraception.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true. If it were simply a matter of access to good contraception, you would have seen a steady increase in childlessness over time rather than a kind of fluctuation that we've seen over the last 200 years. Women who didn't want children were able to achieve childlessness by making use of whatever was available. And up until the recent decades, that usually meant the contraceptive methods that were around backed up by abortion and very frequent use of both of those methods. What I found looking in more recent years, a whole range of reasons. Some people really did talk about not liking children and not wanting any, but those people were really in the minority. Much more common was people who said they really enjoyed children, but they just didn't want any of their own. Some of them were teachers and said, you know, I have children all day long, and when I come home, I would just as soon send them to their parents and have some peace and quiet. Or they would say, you know, I raised 12 younger siblings, and I think I've done my bit for child rearing, and I'm very close to my nieces and nephews, and that's plenty satisfaction for me. And there were all kinds of reasons that people gave.
Did a lot of people feel that they were just too busy with their work to have children?
Yeah, but that wasn't as strong a sentiment as I expected in the letters. I thought more and more people writing in more recent years, especially women, would say, well, you know, I have this job and I want to devote myself to it. More common were the perception and the reality that to combine both was really impossible. Even today, in the era when women are often given the message that you can do it all, that you can have everything, they say, you know, it's just not true, because if I have children, I want to do it not by dropping my kids off at a daycare center, but by really raising them, and I can't do both. I need to work, I want to work, and so I'm just not going to have children. More often, though, they described a lifestyle that they had carved out for themselves that would be disrupted by having children, whether it had to do with travel or leisure time or even consumer spending. One of the interesting things I found was that people in the 1940s and 50s during the baby boom era didn't imagine their children as competing consumers within the family, as actually competing with the parents for the use of the family's money. They really saw family spending as a kind of unified endeavor. We are going to spend money together on the family vacation or on the new appliance or the barbecue or whatever it happened to be. But in more recent years, especially those who wanted to remain childless talked about children as competing consumers. I couldn't stand it, they would write, if I had to buy my kid a $200 Nintendo or a $100 pair of tennis shoes or save for a college education. I wouldn't be able to do the things I want to do, and I want to travel, and I want to have nice things in my house. I had a lot of people write and say things like, I hate Tupperware and Herculean. I want to have white rugs, and I want to be able to drink red wine in my house and not worry about things getting spilled.
Another reason given by men and women is that they felt they had enough difficulty parenting the child within.
Yes. There were a lot of New Agers who wrote to me who felt that way, and I was quite taken by how many people used that phraseology, that they were busy raising themselves, raising the child within themselves, nurturing themselves, and they couldn't imagine trying to do that for another human being.
Do you consider women in their 40s today to be the first generation that truly had a choice about whether or not to have children?
No. No, I think really if we look back to the 19th century, the women then also felt that they had a choice, but the choice was really whether or not to marry. And many of them made the choice not to, and that was the way they decided to remain childless. If a woman in the 19th century married, she was almost certainly going to have children, unless there was some infertility problem on her part or on her husband's part.
But you mean to remain celibate, I think.
Right.
So the choice to remain celibate and the choice to have to not have children, I mean, that's two really different things. I mean, I know there, realize what the relationship is, but, you know, how many people really want to take a vow of celibacy for their whole adult life?
Well, a lot of people did in the 19th century. Maybe not a lot, but enough to count. The Shaker community, for example, was a large and thriving community for many decades based on total community celibacy, and families joined. Men and women who were married to each other, sometimes with their children, joined, and they had the backing of a very strong community, and they could bring their family life together into the Shaker community and live a celibate life and not risk the dangers of pregnancy and childbirth.
You've become something of a historian of the American family. And I wonder if you think most Americans today make certain assumptions about what families are and what's, you know, quote, normal in family life. And if you think history disproves most of these common assumptions.
Well, I don't think most Americans really do have an idea about what's normal. I think most Americans think that their own situation is normal for them, and they're right. There is really no eternal family life. There is no traditional family, which is a word that gets thrown around. The family has always been in transition. It's always been a changing institution. There's always been tremendous variations of how people live their private lives and arrange their sexual lives and their reproductive selves. And we can't really look back and say there's any particular family form that existed and is now suddenly being shattered. It's just not true.
What are some of the variations that you find earlier on in American history?
Well, for one thing, most children did not live to become adults with the two parents who gave them birth. In the early days, the death rate was so high that most children lost at least one parent during their childhood and were often raised by more than one sets of parents. So single parenthood is nothing new, and being raised by non-biological parents is nothing new. And those kinds of arrangements, of course, were very common. We're often told that the divorce rate indicates a much higher rate of family breakdown than ever in the past. But again, if we look at death or desertion or just the fact of families coming apart because one member of the family, usually the father, has to move to find work, we find a lot of disruption in the past that mirrors statistically some of the kinds of phenomena we see today, but they were caused by different things.
Is there a demarcation point where you think it became respectable for a woman or a man to choose to remain childless?
Well, if you're talking about married people, because I think it was certainly a respectable choice in the 19th century to choose to remain childless and not married. And in fact, I think there were times when women and men, but especially women, and there's some evidence of this, would choose to remain childless and people would assume they were infertile. And that was also respectable because...
You had no choice.
If there wasn't very effective means of treating infertility, then how could you blame someone if they were childless? It was probably just a problem. I think that it is more acceptable now, but the people who wrote to me still talked about the stigma that attaches to being childless, making that choice, that it may be more acceptable, but it's still not fully acceptable. People are still feeling that somehow people look at them odd, people ask them strange questions about what's wrong with you anyway that you don't want children, or they treat them like they're not full adults or full citizens, like they have something wrong with them if they want to make this choice.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Elaine Tyler May is the author of Barren in the Promised Land. She's a professor of American Studies at the University of Minnesota. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing from Tom Jelton, who's in the former Yugoslavia, but reporting on an action by the Rapid Reaction Force. For the first time yesterday, French artillery fired on Bosnian Serbs. Also, we'll be hearing the news from Washington that the United States has named a new team of diplomats to continue mediation efforts in Bosnia. They will succeed the three U.S. diplomats who died in an accident in Bosnia last week. Also, Israel reports making arrests in the Jerusalem bus bombing. And Susan Stamberg will report on artists whose creations are for a movie in which the artwork is destroyed. Those stories coming up today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, if jazz fans paid attention to the critics, pianist and composer Herbie Nichols, who died in 1963, would be a lot more popular than he is. Not that that would stop a critic from trying again. Kevin reviews two new CDs of Nichols' music, one a reissue of a 1957 trio session, the other featuring new interpretations of his music.
In jazz, as in other fields, dying is a good career move. It's how unrecognized geniuses get recognized. But popular success continues to elude the late Herbie Nichols, despite the rollicking charm of his piano playing, his catchy tunes, and oddball harmony. He even wrote the music for Billie Holiday's theme song, Lady Sings the Blues. Maybe the problem is Nichols didn't record much. He did only a few sessions under his own name, all in the 1950s. The last of them, a 1957 album with the cheery title Love, Gloom, Cash, Love, is now on CD from the Bethlehem label. It's not Nichols' best work. His trio dates for Blue Note take those honors, but it has some great moments. This is from his Portrait of Ucha. Thank you. Herbie Nichols, bassist George DeVivier, and drummer Danny Richmond. Nichols only made trio records, but always wanted to have his music played by a larger band with horns and strings. His friend Buell Neidlinger, a jazz and classical bass player, belatedly honors that wish with his new album, Blue Chopsticks, on his K2B2 label. 11 Nichols tunes are arranged for a quintet, including saxophonist Marty Crystal, violinist Richard Green, and Neidlinger on cello. For the record, Buell Neidlinger isn't the first to arrange Herbie Nichols' music for strings and horns. Dutch pianist Misha Mengelberg did it in the mid-1980s, and did it better, if you ask me. Nichols' tunes continue to be popular with a few discriminating musicians. Saxophonists Steve Lacy and Philip Johnston, and pianists Jerry Allen, Ethan Iverson, and Frank Kimbrough have recorded some. And New York's Jazz Composers Collective presents whole concerts of Nichols' music. If you want to check out the original, start with a one-CD Blue Note anthology, The Art of Herbie Nichols, or with Love, Gloom, Cash, Love. But do it! Nichols is way too good to be left just to the experts.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Pulse and CD Review. He reviewed Herbie Nichols' Love, Gloom, Cash, Love on the Bethlehem label and the Buell Neidlinger Quintet's Blue Chopsticks on the K2B2 label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Sacrifice of Isaac, a new novel from Neil Gordon. This is NPR, National Public Radio.